The next case on our calendar is 08-1460, City of Youngstown versus Jamie Traylor. Mr. Maseko.
Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices, may it please the court. I'm Attorney Joseph Maseko on behalf of the appellant, City of Youngstown. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for the purposes of rebuttal. There's a world of difference between a state actor walking up to someone and saying, "That's a vicious dog, where's your pen and your insurance?" as opposed to, "Your dog just attacked someone and you're under arrest." The former was found to violate principles of due process by a majority in Cowan. The latter is the question that is before you today, and it is my position that it does not violate principles of due process. In fact, it invokes the greatest principles of due process, that being representation by counsel before a court of law. It is the position of the appellant that the ordinance at issue today is entirely distinguishable from the Cowan decision and from Revised Code 955. 11 and 22. If it were only that simple, I suspect I would not be here today. However, to reach the analysis that is necessary to resolve the ultimate question, we need to reach into the heart of Cowan itself. With utmost respect to the justices on the panel in the Cowan majority, it is my position that Cowan was well-intentioned but somewhat misguided. What I mean by that is that it was the correct decision, but on the wrong facts. The Cowan decision is correct for purely labeling cases. In other words, the first example I gave when I stepped to the podium, a state actor walks up where the dog has done nothing and simply labels it vicious. It does not function in a situation where there's actually a bite. When a bite occurs due to an unprovoked response by a dog and it is unconfined or off the property, the analysis of Cowan does not work. And I say that because that is the concern of Cowan as opposed to the decision that I make every day as prosecutor for the City of Youngstown in thousands of cases a year and in the excess of 10,000 cases in my career. I look at the facts, I apply them to the law, and I determine if probable cause exists to bring forth a prosecution. That is exactly the case here. 505-19, the city's vicious dog ordinance, does not permit for any pre-charge determination or obligation. There is no pen requirement, there is no leash requirement, there is no requirement. And indeed, in this case, before the 7th District reversed the conviction, Mr. Traylor would have been under no obligations under 505-19, even post-conviction.
Counsel, is it a problem in this case that this dog doesn't get its first bite, so to speak, that the owner, even though it's defined as a vicious dog, and so we have strict liability, is there a problem with strict liability when the person doesn't know that the dog has those propensities?
No, Your Honor. Any dog has that type of propensity. And 505-19, just like any leash law or any regulatory measure that any municipality or jurisdiction would enact, is a common sense measure designed to protect the public from a bite. Any dog can charge, any dog can growl, any dog can bite. The burdens that are at issue here arise at the time of ownership. So there is really no notice issue that's necessary. Simply by virtue of dog ownership, duties and obligations are placed upon you to protect the public at large from being bitten by your animal if it is off your property.
So, counsel, if these dogs had been observed outside of, going beyond the premises, of the yard or the property, and had not been, had not bitten anyone or an another animal, the only penalty that the owner would have been subjected to would have been a dog at large.
Exactly, a violation of a leash law.
Right. And here, based on the owner's, any dog owner's responsibility to control your animal, because of the severity of the attack, he's charged with the violation of the code, the Youngstown code.
Yes,
that
sir.
Prohibits this activity.
Yes.
So it's not a pre-classification of these dogs, the Italian Mastiff, Cane Corsos, as being vicious.
No, Your Honor. And when I initially started looking at this case, I was thinking that Tellings may not lend much to this analysis because Tellings was so narrow and dealt with the subsection of 955.11 that specifically mentions pit bull type dogs. However, as I worked this over and over, I found that Tellings actually is somewhat helpful. And the critical distinction is that in Tellings, there was no attack. So we are dealing with that labeling type of situation that I mentioned. The violation in Tellings was that the person, the owner, Paul Tellings, owned multiple pit bull animals. This court distinguished Cowan and ID'd the issue as stated. But what we're really looking at, it's somewhat the same, and that's why I think Tellings will actually be what carries the day here. Because if I walk up as a state actor and say, this dog is a pit bull, and therefore you have obligations, you're on notice under revised code, perhaps you're on notice under municipal ordinance, isn't that really still the same as what Cowan's is dealing with? And I say it's still the same because what if I take the position that the dog's not a pit bull? Aren't we dealing with that same unilateral type of decision that was of concern in Cowan? And Justice Cupp, going back to your original question, it's not a concern because everyone is on notice. Owners of pit bulls are perhaps on a greater level of notice because they're specifically named, but any dog owner is on notice of their obligations and duties, whether it flow from the revised code or whether it flow from a Youngstown City ordinance.
But as long as there's the ability, the vehicle to challenge the determination of the breed of the dog, that's what Cowan says. As long as that's in place, there's recourse for the defendant, and that makes it constitutional.
Yes. Yes, and that is exactly the case, just so far. I would, in addition to mentioning Tellings, certainly direct the court to the decisions of the 2nd and 10th districts in Ride and Conti. Those decisions started to bear out my position here today and the position that I've always maintained since the inception of these proceedings. In Ride and Conti, those reviewing courts recognized that absent some predetermination or pre-charge obligation, ordinances that deal with dog bites and indeed 955 to a lesser extent are constitutional and pass the due process muster. The Cowan decision itself at paragraph 14 mentions a major concern over the fact that the determination of viciousness was removed from the jury's consideration. In the trailer case and under our ordinance, that determination of viciousness must be made by a trier of fact, whether it be the trial court judge in a trial to the bench or by the jury, as in this case. And any future status of the dog can only take place after the jury or the judge returns their verdicts. As stated in my brief, it is my position that the 7th District did lose their way in making their determination and reversing and vacating Jamie Traylor's conviction. They read portions of 955 into 505.19 that are simply not there, and they began their analysis with a faulty premise. I would ask this court to reverse the decision of the 7th District Court of Appeals and to reinstate the conviction and to promulgate the proposition of law as I have set it forth in my brief. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Maseko. Mr. Lanzo.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm Attorney James E. Lanzo on behalf of the appellee, Jamie Traylor, in this matter. The city draws a distinction, the city draws a distinction between the state statutes and the city ordinance in this matter. However, the distinction that the city draws is not there. There are indeed requirements imposed upon owners of vicious dogs under the ordinance that are not imposed upon owners of every dog in the city. The ordinance makes it a crime to have a vicious dog unconfined and then defines what unconfined is. And it defines unconfined as a dog that is not restrained by a secure fence, secure enclosure, or other security device. This definition of unconfined, it puts much more burden on the owner of a dog, the owner of a dog that is defined as vicious than the owner of a simply a normal canine or a regularly classified canine.
Is that an unfair burden to say that a vicious dog should be confined, or is your issue that the owner doesn't know the dog is vicious till it bites someone?
Well, it's a stepped up burden upon the owner of a vicious dog, and it's not unfair until you don't know. You could never tell. The facts in this case, the facts in the Conti case, the owner of the dogs themselves would never know that their dog was vicious until they were actually convicted.
Well, until they were convicted, or until the dog did something to indicate it was vicious. I mean, wouldn't you know that you had a vicious dog if the dog attacked another dog or showed the propensity, as the statute says, with a propensity, tendency, or disposition to attack or cause injury to or otherwise endanger the safety of human beings or other domestic animals?
I mean, you would know, and that would be certainly a constructive notice. But in this case and the Conti case, there's no constructive notice until after essentially the leash violation occurs. The dogs are outside of the owner's control, as can happen with any dog, as can happen, and the dog does what really any dog could do. Okay, the ordinance places a special burden to restrain the animals in under special conditions beyond mere supervision, as with a standard leash law.
And are you saying that that's unreasonable, or I'm not sure what you're saying about that?
I'm saying that it's not the burden is not unreasonable if you know your animal is vicious. If you have a pit bull, you are on notice. As the court decided in Tellings, you are on notice. You must comply. And if your dog gets loose, you will violate a vicious dog law. In this case, there is no notice. There's no notice to the owner that, hey, your dog's vicious. And it flies in the face, as I briefed it to one of the gravamen of due process, to be able to choose affirmatively, I don't want to violate the law. Possibly if I have a vicious dog, I will buy the enclosure. I will spend the money on the fence. Or I will choose, if I've been notified that my dog is vicious, I don't want to possess a vicious animal anymore.
Are you arguing that everyone's entitled to one free bite before that determination?
All I'm arguing is that the way this ordinance is set up and the way it's applied here, you can't decide. You can't. I'm not arguing that everyone's entitled to one free bite. I'm arguing that everyone's entitled to notice that my animal is vicious.
Well, you have. I think you would have to agree that every dog is capable of biting somebody else. Even the most mild-mannered dog can go off the handle and bite somebody.
Yes.
So if you know of this statute and you choose to take a chance that your dog's never going to bite anybody and not confine them, then you're taking that risk of running afoul of the statute. Have noticed that if you think your dog might not be vicious because it's a nice, sweet little dog, you're not going to put a fence up, you're not going to restrain him, and the dog ends up biting at somebody else. Now, you've had notice that it could be vicious and you chose not to take the risks. You chose not to deal with the risk by putting up the fence, and now you have to deal with the consequences of the law.
The distinction, I believe, is that the putting up of the fence and the special confinement issues apply only to vicious animals. The law says this applies to vicious animals.
And you take a chance that your dog's not going to be vicious because you've just said you aren't requiring a one free bite. So every dog has the capacity to be vicious. You should restrain every dog, and if you don't, you run the risk of violating the statute.
If this ordinance applied to every dog and didn't define vicious dogs, or if there wasn't a distinction drawn in the statutes between every other dog and vicious dogs, possibly.
How would you define vicious dog then?
How would I define vicious dog?
To make this constitutional, in your opinion, how would you define a vicious dog?
A vicious dog is a dog under the statute that is a pit bull or that has
either
bitten somebody.
Okay, so
or previously showed the propensity. And
okay, so
without
you're back to
any
one
that,
free bite.
Or the propensity. The ordinance is much more expansive than the statute. It says the mere propensity,
So if my dog's growled at somebody, does that put me on notice that I might have a vicious dog now?
I don't know. I'm certainly not a canine expert. And I think that's part of the reason why if you're going to define dogs, either you have a breed-specific definition, as in Tellings, which is clear, which puts everybody on notice. If you have this type of breed, you have to do this. Or you have a prior judicial determination, and I would refer the court to Ride as well, the Second District opinion. I believe the Second District hits the nail right on the head. In that case, we have dogs running at large, a leash violation. Those dogs attack, I believe it's another dog, a Yorkshire Terrier. The court in that case, and certainly prosecutor's office in that case, only charged a leash violation. The court made a finding that, yes, you were in violation of leash violation, and here's a further determination. We're finding your dogs to be vicious, and you are now put on notice that in the future, you have to comply with the vicious dog laws.
So you keep going back to, if you're not a breed specific, you get a free bite.
I think you're entitled to notice. You need to know.
Who's entitled to notice? I guess your argument seems to me to say the responsibility is on the person here, such as the person here, who had her wrist and hand subject to surgery because this dog attacked her totally unprovoked, and then attacked the police officer. Again, the police officer, I guess, had a shotgun. Maybe the dog thought it was threatened, but dog attacked her. Why should we, and it seems to me Youngstown has decided not to, place the burden on the people who maybe are injured first, then we know, now it's a vicious dog, and the owner has no responsibility to know that their dog may be vicious. It's hard for me to believe, I guess, in these facts, that this dog didn't have some propensity when it just attacked somebody out on the sidewalk and then attacked somebody getting out of a car, that didn't have some propensity that the owner may have known about and let the dog run. I guess my point is, sense of responsibility here, that the ordinance, the city of Youngstown has decided we're going to put the burden on the dog owner to keep their dog confined, controlled. And what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with putting the dog, to making the dog owner responsible to keeping a dog confined or controlled. The difference is there are different standards for confinement and control with a non-vicious, non-determined to be vicious or dangerous canine and a vicious or dangerous canine.
So if the ordinance said everybody keep your dog confined, that or every dog owner keep your dog confined, then the statute, then the ordinance would be acceptable. Is that right?
I believe if the legislature, the city of Youngstown, chose to apply these standards across the board, then we're probably not arguing this case.
What do you mean
right
by across the board? Do you mean to every dog owner?
To every single dog owner. And it puts every single dog owner on notice that you have special requirements, that there are these stepped up issues. But what the legislature, city of Youngstown, does is defines vicious dogs, then places these special confinement requirements on the owners of vicious dogs, and then whether you know you have a vicious dog or not, whether you have any notice that your dog might have a propensity to bite or attack or not, if your dog gets out and attacks somebody, now your dog's sort of retroactively vicious, and you should have had a fence, and you should have had an enclosure, and you should have had a device rather than just a leash or, I mean, many people, and I believe that's why, I certainly don't know the mind of the legislature, but I believe that's why the legislature puts in the restrainment requirements of a non-vicious animal, supervision. Because I see it every day on my way to work, and I'm sure many people here do. Somebody opens their door and lets their dog out to use the facility in the yard and then cleans up the yard and doesn't have this dog necessarily on a leash, but the dog is confined within the yard and they supervise the dog and the dog's never ran away before, et cetera. But if that dog were a pit bull, or if that dog had bitten somebody, or if you had this propensity notice, if you had even constructive notice, you would know, well, we have to keep this dog on a chain link leash less than 6 feet. We have to keep this dog in a fenced in yard. We have to do these things that the ordinance tells us to do and that the statute tells us to do.
Yeah, we have statutes, I think we still do, have statutes that place upon parents of children, minor children, obligations, duties, and liability for the conduct of one's child. I don't know whether they're criminal statutes or not, but even civil liability statutes. Would a defense then for a parent be to, well, I didn't know my child was going to, you know, do what my child did. Never did that before. I can't believe my son did that. The son gets one chance. Now I know that my son may conduct himself that way, so now I can be liable. That's not an argument, is it, that's made?
Your Honor, I believe those statutes, the statutes imposing civil liability for the affirmative actions of minors on the parents and capping the civil liability, if those are the statutes we're referring to, those are civil statutes. This is certainly it's certainly a different.
But the principle,
it's a different standard.
I understand the difference between criminal and civil, certainly, but the principle is the same, is it not? I'm not liable either civilly or criminally until I know the conduct of my dog or my son is what it is.
If we had a distinct definition of and excuse me.
Son's conduct, no, it's impossible, isn't it?
Yeah, if we had a distinct definition for vicious child,
right,
that would be, it'd be different. But we don't have that distinction. That sort of applies across the board. And in those cases, those civil cases, we're not talking about taking away anyone's freedom. I mean, in a case like this, someone's freedom is legitimately on the line.
Mr. Lanzo, you seem to be arguing that we ought to go back to Cowan, because in Cowan we had the actor designate animals to be vicious, and that seems to fit your argument here, that you want some notice in advance that you have a duty to confine your animal, and that isn't what the law is. What happens here is we have a proceeding when the viciousness of the animal is at issue, and the owner can say the animal is not vicious, and the state has the burden to prove that it is. How could that be more fair than having the very issue open to discussion and resolution?
Your Honor, having the issue open to discussion and resolution is certainly fair. However, as the Cowan court said, and the Seventh District's opinion agrees with both Cowan and Tellings. What this court said in Cowan is that a meaningful time to make this distinction, a meaningful time to be heard on viciousness, is not at the criminal trial, is not when liberty is on the line. A meaningful time to be heard is before. And this goes back to my notice argument. This goes, and Tellings is right in line with Cowan on this issue. You have some sort of notice before you're exposed to criminal liability. So you can affirmatively choose, I'm going to obey the law. I'm going to get the special confinements, or I'm going to...
But you're putting the burden then on the victim as opposed to the owner. After someone's already been bitten or after someone's already been attacked, they've had to suffer that. Now the owner is aware. Why shouldn't the owner have the responsibility? The animal is property.
The owner has responsibilities under a leash law. Just as the owner in Ride has had the responsibility under the leash law and was found guilty merely of a violation of the lease law. I'm not removing the responsibility of the owner in my argument, nor am I placing the burden necessarily on the victim of a dog bite. The victim of a dog bite has other recourse. The victim of a dog bite can sue. The victim of the dog bite has several steps of recourse to make themselves whole. What I'm arguing is that before we subject someone to the potentiality of taking away their freedom, they should know, hey, your dog's vicious and you need to confine it in a special manner, or you should divest yourself of it if you don't want to risk running afoul of these statutes.
Isn't that the risk of owning a dog? And while I'm heartened by the chief's comparison to dogs to children, which I feel is very apt, I still think that there's an owner's responsibility, and there is the ability to defend against this charge. For example, had the dogs been provoked, had they been threatened themselves, there may be a defense here.
There may be.
And that's an opportunity for the defendant to, as is afforded to all individuals who are charged with a crime. It's not your dog bit somebody, therefore you're guilty. There's a process, there's a fact finding, there's a trial, there's defenses available.
There are defenses available, but this application, the application we're talking about of this particular ordinance, is really unlike other criminal statutes. The easiest example certainly is speeding. You can affirmatively choose not to speed. You may decide not to pay attention to the road sign, and accelerate, but you could pay attention and not accelerate beyond the posted speed limit. In this case, you have no notice, and clearly there's a distinction. This is a vicious dog statute. You have no notice that your dog is vicious, and you have no notice that you're on this heightened standard, and you have no notice that if your dog breaks free and potentially bites somebody, that because it's a vicious dog, you could be subject to going to jail now. I think that's the distinction. I'm not arguing against leash laws. I'm not arguing that dogs should be allowed to run free and beyond their owner's control. I'm arguing that before we get to this heightened level, a dog owner should know, either because of a breed-specific classification or because of a prior to a criminal proceeding determination, that your dog is a vicious animal. The law will see it as a vicious animal. And I see I'm out of time, and with that, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lanzo. Mr. Maseko, you've saved a little more than 5 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'll be brief. Adopting the appellee's position would leave the public at risk and victims without recourse. I'll give the court two extreme examples to illustrate that. If some mean soul out there decided they were going to have a dog, a non-pit bull dog, and just torment that dog every day, shock it, prod it, not feed it, just make it into this monster, and then one day let it go. It's never bit anyone before. To adopt the appellee's position, they get it, that dog, or the owner of that dog, couldn't be prosecuted. The other example on the other end.
No, I'm not understanding. You said you're leaving the victims without recourse. What does that mean?
Well, for example, Your Honor, if in this case Mr. Rock, whose hand was torn open by these mastiffs, if we're required to give notice after the first bite, Mr. Rock would have no criminal recourse. He certainly could go to civil court and sue for the extent of his injuries, but the police department or our dog warden agency could not bring that case to me and initiate a prosecution if we were to adopt their position, if we were to adopt that one free bite or lack of notice argument. That's all I was trying to illustrate.
So you view the criminal system as recourse for victims?
Yes, additional recourse in addition to any other remedies that may be available. Because in this case, upon conviction, the court may in fact order restitution, could label the dog vicious, could order the destruction of the dog, anything within the reasonable sentencing ability of a court.
All right. Generally in criminal cases, it's the state or the city who is seeking recourse.
Yes, for a violation of the public laws, but the victim will benefit from that if we're able to secure a conviction and restitution were ordered by the trial court.
Some satisfaction.
Some satisfaction, Your Honor.
All right.
The other example that I would offer the court would be a little old lady who coddles a dog its entire life, and just one day it runs out and bites a kid walking down the sidewalk. We don't have to give her notice. Hopefully a prosecutor would exercise their discretion in that case, but it's the same thing. Notice is required, no more notice than the ordinance is required by virtue of dog ownership. No.
Isn't this essentially a risk shifting? You're putting the burden on someone who owns a dog with the recognition that any dog can bite, and you're putting the risk on them instead of some innocent passerbyer.
Yes, Justice Stratton, that's exactly correct.
Although it appears that counsel is arguing the ordinance is too narrowly drawn, which is unusual. Normally, the argument is the ordinance is too broad. Here, it seems that the argument is the vicious dog is the one that is being targeted, or the owner is targeted for behavior of the vicious dog as opposed to any dog.
Yes. If I had my druthers, I wish it said any dog. I would certainly prefer that. In this case, City Council has greatly complicated my life.
Counsel, I want to take you back to your example. In your example, the nasty old codger who beats his dog, the ordinance applies, and it doesn't apply to the nice little old lady.
It would apply in both cases, Your Honor.
Well, that's what I thought.
Yes, it would apply in both cases. It's just that I was trying to illustrate the consequences of a one free bite scenario. So in both...
And you suggested in the case of the little old lady, there wouldn't be consequences.
Oh, there would be consequences. What I said was I hope that a prosecutor would exercise their discretion.
Okay, so now you're suggesting there aren't consequences because the prosecutor will be a nice person.
What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that every case is different.
But, counsel, there is the potential for uniform application of the statute, no matter the circumstances, if there is a dog that is vicious?
Yes.
That attacks, as in this case?
Yes.
That two dogs that had to be put down by the police when they were attacking the police. And quite frankly, under the defendant or the appellee's scenario, someone could know their dog was vicious and deny it. And say, I had no idea that my dog would attack another smaller dog and a human being. I mean, who's to say, what level of forewarning? So this is a case of whether, is the statute equally applied, no matter what the circumstances, to dogs that bite human beings or other animals?
This ordinance has absolute potential for uniform application based upon a prosecutor's discretion. So the short answer is yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Maseko. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Yep.